Well, the world is dumpster fire, and nothing here makes sense. And you vacillate between crippling fear and constant self-defense. And nothing's right and nothing's good, and you're paralyzed with grief. Don't kill yourself, just have a cup of coffee.
Welcome to Coffee Over Suicide, the dramedy podcast about mental illness and choosing life over death, one cup of coffee at a time. I'm your host, Chris Parker Howard. And there it is, the new theme song. I just recorded that yesterday, which is going to be a few days ago by the time this thing comes out. But I am all settled in the new studio, in the new space, in lovely, lovely Silver Strand Beach in California. It's been a really interesting time, hasn't it? I don't know. Has anything been going on since we last talked? Of course, we're all in lockdown. We're all staying in our own homes. We're all self-isolating. We're all going fucking crazy. It's been a little nuts. And one of the casualties of how crazy all of this has been was today's conversation. You see, the thing is, this conversation was recorded back when I was still in the studio in Denver, and I had a hard drive malfunction, and I thought I had already gotten everything ready and set to publish for the podcast before I wrapped the season. And I hadn't. There were a few conversations that didn't make it. And I've reached out to Tyler. I've apologized. I haven't heard back. So as of today, you could be hearing a conversation between two people before they had a blood feud. We don't know. But this conversation is excellent. And I was able to recover it, thank goodness. I have two other conversations that the files are missing. But the project exists, so who knows if those will ever come out. But if you're one of those people, you've been contacted and rescheduled. But enough about that. Let's talk a little bit about gratitude and how we can enhance ourselves with gratitude during this difficult, difficult time. Because I'm going to be honest with you, being out in public is difficult enough as is, but right now, it seems a little crazy with the toilet paper there, people. Toilet paper, napkins, tissues, all gone. Grocery stores look like they've been picked over by a pack of hyenas. It looks like the beginning of a Walking Dead episode. You know what I mean? It's a little weird out there. Why are we being so weird? And yet, the moment I hear somebody coughing, I get a little anxious. And all I want to do is rub my hands all over my face. And I can't. I just can't. And neither should you. And hopefully we're all washing our hands and we're all knowing why it is what we're doing for ourselves is important to keep people safe. Trust science, okay? Just listen to scientists, listen to doctors, and if you hear something that sounds dubious, get a second source. Figure out where your information is coming from and if that information is credible. And enough about me lecturing you on information. Let's try to have a good time since we're here. Speaking of having a good time, the conversation today with Tyler Smith is an excellent one. We have a good time. We have a lot of fun. We have a lot of laughs. We talk about some dark stuff. We talk about some light stuff. And I think you're going to have a good time with it because it came from a simpler time. Back when we could all touch our faces and touch each other's faces and didn't have to wash our hands so much and we'd eat food right off the floor. So here it is. My conversation, season opener of season 3 of Coffee Over Suicide, my friend, until I hear otherwise, Tyler Smith. my wife and I got married, I decided, yeah, let's both have each other's names.
Mm.
And so we both became Parker Howards.
Okay.
But Howard is my original name, and okay. I'm originally from Michigan.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was – so the fact that it said Chris Parker Howard, and I went to school with Chris Howard in Parker, it just is like, this is just a little too close to what's going on, in which case – and if you had been that Chris Howard, I'm not super interested in talking about my mental issues with you, because then we can trace it back to when Chris Howard made fun of me for not knowing how to ride a bike.
Oh, holy shit! So your bully was Chris Howard.
No,
for a minute.
For a minute, yeah.
Okay.
He wasn't so much a bully. He was just he was just an asshole.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's fair. It's you know,
we're all assholes.
Yeah.
I was kind of a bully myself at times.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that. Like what was that all about?
I was an overweight kid and I'm an overweight adult, and mm-hmm. I also did not see myself as having any real talents. Turns out that it's just I had not discovered them yet.
Yeah.
And so I looked at friends who were better looking in better shape and were more obviously gifted, and just everybody, whether it be in high school or my church or whatever, everybody just seemed to like value them. And I just felt so valueless that I had this, you know, just that stupid middle school attitude that like, it's like, oh, I'll take them down a peg. It was never physical, but it was usually verbal. And it was really just, it's that textbook idea of like trying to make them feel worse because I feel so bad.
Yeah. No, completely. I think just about everybody has that to some degree. I mean, you know, especially when you're younger, you divide into those cliques because mm-hmm. you want to find your people, but you also find the people that you're not. You know what I mean? Like, you can start defining yourself by who you aren't.
Yeah, that's true. And I think obviously there's finding any level of definition, especially in a negative way, I think can be dangerous because it's possible to back away from something. I think it's good to sort of by process of elimination be like, all right, so I'm not an athlete. Got it.
Right.
But to like distance yourself philosophically, then eventually get to a point where you start to demonize the idea of athleticism and say that it's somehow less than. And it's like, no, you don't have to go that far. You just have to say you're not that and then move on. That's always been my issue.
Yeah. That's a lot of people. I mean, it is definitely a thing where you can start to, demonize things by judging yourself against them, you know, especially when you've got insecurities, you know, like I had, I remember in one of my previous relationships back when I was, way more insecure than I am now. That if my girlfriend wanted to dance, I'm a terrible dancer.
Oh, I hear you.
So I looked at all dancing as dancing is the enemy.
Sure.
Because dancing is what's going to take you away from me. So I have to make dancing awful for you as well.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So that
did that work? That'd be that would really get me out of a jam.
Of course it didn't work. You know, it just made me an asshole and you know, we're not together anymore.
Yeah, that's how I am now with hiking. I hate hiking so much. Like, granted, I don't like most athletic things.
Yeah.
But there's just everything about hiking just 9 times out of 10, it's hot.
Yeah.
And then it's like, hey, you want to – so several years ago – are we recording now or are we just talking? I forget.
Oh, yeah, we're going.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So many years ago, I was hiking with my my wife's family, and they are – they're from Minnesota. They're athletic and all that sort of thing. And I went on a hike with my wife and her parents, all of whom were doing it enthusiastically. And sort of my coping mechanism was that the whole time I was just tweeting about hiking and how horrible it is. And so it was like, hey, would you like to be next to somebody but be too out of breath to talk to them? Try hiking. It's like, would you ever want to actively approach a rattlesnake in the wild? Why not try hiking? And it was just, and that helped a lot, but it's definitely, and then my wife and I and some friends, we just went to Scotland and there was a lot of hiking there.
Yeah.
And I just, it really is one of those things where I need to work harder on being like, this is what my friends want to do. This is what my wife wants to do. I hate every single moment of it. Yeah. No view, in my opinion, no view is worth a hike ever. All right.
Yeah. I completely understand that point of view. It's difficult to find your place in something that is so alien and so outside of your comfort zone and your experience, even.
Especially when everybody else seems to agree that it's the best.
Yeah.
You know, because it makes you an outlier in every single way. And I think, honestly, if I were in better shape, or one could say, if I were just a different person, I would probably like hiking quite a bit. But as I find myself thinking regularly, unfortunately, I'm me. And thus, extremely limited in what I enjoy and what I'm good at.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that you can do in cases like that, and this is the only way I've ever found to make it through mm-hmm. something that I find to be completely interminable, is I tell myself I cannot wait to tell the story of how terrible this was later.
but therein lay the potential issue of seeming like a whiner.
Yeah.
Or if it's something, once again, that everybody agrees is just the fucking best. I'm sorry. I don't remember if we're allowed to swear.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
If everybody thinks it's the best, then they're like, wait, why is this guy telling a story about how unlike us he is? Which is what it boils down to. So I think for me in this case, it really just has to be a change of attitude. I'm not going to be able to force myself to enjoy hiking, because how could I? It's pure torture. But I can try to be less verbal about my dislike for it, certainly in the moment.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that you've got any sort of control over in a situation like that is how you're going to choose to react to it.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, you can react loud, dramatic, or you can just say, "And fuck it, this is what this is."
I find myself thinking that most of the time.
That's not a bad place to be, though.
that's true. Yeah,
but I mean, to your point about the fact that it could be difficult to express your displeasure, mm-hmm. I have a remedy for that. And
okay.
This may or may not be true, but it is something that I live by, and it's probably wrong, but I live by the idea that if it's funny, you can't get mad. So if you tell the story about how terrible hiking is, as long as you make that story funny, nobody can get mad at you.
So I agree with you. Once again, I'm also not sure if that's a long-term solution.
Well, funny is also subjective, so that's
– yeah. But it goes back to this idea that I think is a very common thing. Just in talking to you for a couple minutes, I can tell that you're probably an amusing person and that you can tell a story well, you can tell a joke well. I know a lot of comedians out here, so I'm not going to say that I am funny when I talk to so many actually funny people, but – compared to your average person, I'm not bad with an audience. I'll put it that way. Whether it be my students, or if I'm giving a lecture, or if I'm just telling a story in front of five or six people. And I think it's one of the things that I sort of learned how to do and learned that I was good at, as opposed to any of these other things that middle schoolers and high schoolers like to do. It is still astonishing to me that there are people, like many people, most people, that are bad at public speaking and are terrified of public speaking.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I if I'm able, like you said, if I can take this negative experience and turn it into a story, a well-told story that probably has little jokes in there and maybe even artificially or not, extrapolate a deeper truth from it, then people will be like, oh, wow, yeah, that's, you know, and suddenly it doesn't seem like I'm complaining, or they're perfectly fine with my complaining because they got some laughs out of it. So like the idea of humor and showmanship, I would say, as a coping mechanism is something that definitely I learned young.
Well, and you can talk yourself into a different point of view on something.
Sure.
To fit the narrative that you wish you had.
That's a great way of saying it. Yes. It's interesting. I sadly did not have a great deal of time to do research into your show, except the basic description of it and just the idea of people talking about their mental issues, emotional issues, traumatic issues, and that sort of thing, and just talking about the way in which the different ways in which they have made it work or not work. I think it's something that's very valuable. And the idea of having as deep an understanding of your own issues and your own circumstances as possible, I think that's a big step in the right direction. And so the idea of like the narrative of who you wish you were versus who you are, some of it is aspirational and some of it is, I think, pragmatic. Like, there are things I cannot change about myself. There are things I can. And I think to go to that old idea of, you know, understanding the difference between the two, I think that is very important, regardless of whatever issues you might have as a person.
It's necessary to have a level of honesty with yourself.
Yeah.
You've got to be truthful, because you can't just, you know, spray sunshine up your ass and tell yourself something that's completely not true.
Yeah.
I mean, you can certainly find the positive aspects of yourself and the things about yourself that you've got control over, but there are certain things where choosing your language differently isn't going to make a lick of difference.
Yeah. And I think the idea, as you were talking about there, the idea of being honest with oneself, that's something that I am constantly thinking about.
It's a hard road.
It is a hard road, but it can also be very liberating. Honesty can be very liberating because as I get older, when I was younger, I thought that honesty meant negativity.
Yeah.
All right. Because to such an extent that I did believe, and I still kind of do, but I'm trying to get rid of it, the idea that people don't lie about negativity. Like someone won't say something negative about you as a lie. They'll say nice things as a lie very easily. And so I came to trust negativity way more than positivity. And as time has gone on, one of my biggest issues has been, like, I'd be very honest with myself, brutally so, about my shortcomings. But I would not be honest with myself about my strengths, because I was worried that would get a swell head or something like that.
You're finding the negatives in the positives already.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but I do think that it's, as time has gone on, it's like, no, it's important to be honest with yourself. If you can't be honest with yourself about what you're good at, that's not that helpful either. You know, just understanding that, yeah, there are things you're good at, things you're not good at. You have flaws and strengths. You have all of these things. And to simply emphasize the negative, that's no more honest than to only emphasize the positive. You know, like, understanding yourself as a fully well-rounded person, I think, can do wonders. And that's something that only in the last few years have I started to comprehend. And it's hard. It's been really hard to kind of get rid of the negative thinking. It's never gone completely, of course.
Well, of course.
But it's slightly more balanced now.
Well, tell me a little bit about the process of getting there, because there's a lot of years between all of the things that were completely unacceptable and the acceptable. So
sure.
So how do you get there? What was your path to that like?
I mean, it's kind of strange. So of course, everybody's path is unique, mm-hmm. which is kind of an interesting – everyone just has a specific set of circumstances that can be a help or a hindrance, often both. So I know that for myself, not to go super far back, but I will just say that, like, I was raised in a very kind of a boring suburban family. Mm-hmm. I was raised Protestant. I still am. I'm still a practicing Christian, which can provide its own issues, which I'll talk about in a minute. But it was a perfectly fine way to grow up. But I found that I was a more creative person. I was a more sensitive person, and the world tends to not know exactly how to deal with that. My parents are pretty. I consider myself very lucky to have the parents that I had, because growing up, not merely in the church, but then in the denomination that I did, the vast majority of my friends, their parents were very suspicious of art and very suspicious of movies, especially. Yeah. And my parents were super positive about it. Like, I was very, like, thank God for that. But then I still had a hard time figuring out where I fit in the larger scheme of things. And so finally, probably like the first year that I went off to college and I went to film school and I was doing, it's like, okay, now I see where I fit. But then my father passed away very suddenly at age 50, and that was 17 years ago now. And so that was frustrating, because now I felt, just as he and I were starting to get like really close as kind of like adults or peers, he passed away. And so I felt sort of hobbled by that. And from a faithful from a Christian standpoint, not that I want to hit that too hard, it is that feeling of why me, which then leads to the idea, it's like, well, why not you? If it's going to be someone, why not you? Why somebody else? But it is definitely that feeling that, you know, I look at my friends who, even after all these years, their parents are still around, and I know some people that are, you know, older than me, and they have literally never experienced any sense of loss at all. And it can be a very isolating thing. And so to me, I started to feel like, okay, well, I can't bring up loss because nobody can understand it. And so I'm not going to bring it up, because then I become a burden. And why burden people with something that they have no sense of empathy for? Sympathy, sure, but not necessarily empathy.
Right.
And so that was something I kind of carried with me for a while. And then as time has gone on, like, I got married and my wife and I would have our own issues. And then a few years ago, we discovered that we can't have kids, and that led to a whole thing. And that probably led to it definitely did lead to a distancing between us that actually culminated in some really, really bad times, like almost like close to a divorce, really deep depression on my part, suicidal thoughts and all of that. And at the core of it was this idea, again, to go back to the God thing, this feeling of like, okay, God, so it's not enough that you won't let me have a dad, but you won't let me have a son either. And that was a dark thought. But thankfully, we came out of that together, because both of us were really committed to one another and committed to the idea of being together. So we started going to therapy, the great thing about even couples therapy, which teaches you how to relate to one another in a way that is empathetic and curious and loving and forgiving. And then you come to realize that the tactics that you use there can be applied to other things as well, other relationships.
Absolutely.
Including your relationship with yourself, one could say.
Yeah.
I discovered that I while I have trust issues, I definitely I would cut other people a lot more slack than I would cut myself. And so, of course, our therapist would be like, no, you got to show yourself some of that grace as well.
Yeah.
And so that really helped to such an extent that whenever my wife and I would be like in a bad argument, it gave us something sort of a third party to reference and be like, hey, this is what we did in therapy. You remember how that worked. Let's try to do that now. And it allows both of us to sort of, hey, we agreed that this works, so let's actually do that. And so I guess first thing, if I was going to try to extrapolate some kind of advice from this, I mean, therapy is – I genuinely think that every single person, regardless of how screwed up they might see themselves as, I think everybody would benefit from going to therapy.
I completely agree. Yeah. You know, it's funny. The you mentioned your faith, and I think that one of the things that maybe people don't consider often enough with regards to that is while it can definitely be – a boon in the in the high times. It can also be a vessel for your anger when things are completely wrong, like your father taken away from you, the situation with your wife. I mean, it can almost go completely wrong, because now you've got this place to direct your venom.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you did bring up a really interesting word, and I think probably the most interesting word in all of this that I don't hear from people often enough. And you were talking about being empathetic, but you were also talking about being curious.
Yeah, that's the big word that came out of therapy for us.
Yeah, no shit. I mean, that one right there, that's one that I don't hear often enough from people. And I mean, it hit me like a lightning bolt when you said it, because it's a word you don't hear often enough in your daily life. It's so easy to get caught up in your routines and into taking everything in your life for granted. If you step back and you re-engage that curiosity with everything in your life, asking more questions, it leads to answers. And if you're willing to tackle those answers, because they're not always fun,
sure,
it's really rewarding.
Yeah, I mean, and one thing leads to another. I mean, you can only be curious for so long before you arrive at least some degree of empathy for the other person.
Yeah.
If your wife is furious at you about something, of course my first response is usually shame and guilt and frustration that I've let her down or whatever. But then that will give way to a certain self-defense. And those are just natural responses. That's going to happen. But then, like, okay, intellectually, I have to be like, okay, so there is – she clearly feels hurt in some way. So now if I start asking her questions, or if maybe she's not in the mood for that, then I can start at least thinking, where is this coming from for her? All right? Maybe she's upset with me irrationally. Maybe she's not actually correct in what she is saying, but she still seems to feel it very passionately.
Yeah.
And so I could either just dig in my heels and say, well, I know she's wrong and I know I'm right. So that's the end of it. But this is someone that I do purport to love. And so one way or another, she has perceived the situation as her husband has not taken care of her in some way. And so I feel like asking questions of her about how she's feeling, why she's feeling this way, and as opposed to just jumping to my own defense, I think that has caused us to grow so much closer than both parties just being like, no, I'm right and the other person's wrong, and I just need to convince them of my rightness. I remember Marge Simpson once said that marriage is a beautiful thing, but it's also a constant fight for moral superiority. Now that's meant to be a joke,
yeah.
But if you're not careful, that's what it can turn into. And I think you're right. Like the idea of curiosity is something that can work in every aspect of your life. Once our therapist really started to emphasize that, I found my film criticism getting better because I became way more curious about not merely the characters on screen, but also the perspective of the filmmaker. And it also got me more angry at certain filmmakers who I feel like display a decided lack of curiosity in their work. So everything's connected, of course.
Well, and you mentioned earlier about people being shy and having a dislike of public speaking, but you yourself, you've become a podcaster.
Yeah.
So you found in yourself some things. Tell me how that came about.
You know, it's a good question. It came about initially from it's such it, Let me ask you this,
because this makes me curious.
Okay.
Did you make your podcast because you weren't hearing a podcast that was doing it the way you wanted to hear it?
Yes. I
think that's every podcaster.
I know, but you know what? We started in 2007. Okay.
Yeah. Your numbers are obviously up there. I mean, you've got a following. It's pretty fucking astounding.
In the world of film podcasting, we are not, we're not nearly as high as some of the others, because of what we do and the way we do it. If we were to just pivot to more just talking about one new movie per episode, our numbers would go up, but we're less interested in that because other podcasts are already doing that and doing it well.
Yeah.
And so, no, it came about, I can tell you specifically what it is. In 2006, I started listening to podcasts and I figured, well, I'll just listen to some movie podcasts. And at the time, there were probably more than I thought there were, but the big ones, there was, like NPR had a movie podcast and I would listen to it and they were saying really interesting stuff, but it was also incredibly, like, very, very dry,
right?
Which film criticism tends to be. But it was one of those things like you have to incorporate some level of style into what you're doing, even if it's just your tone of voice or incorporating your personality, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You got to keep people interested in on more than just an intellectual level, in my opinion.
Yeah. Because you're not just selling the information, you're selling you.
Yeah, which is what film criticism is when it comes right down to it. Like some people will tune into a film critic to get like a plot summary, but for the most part, they want to hear this person's opinion. And what does that mean if you don't have a sense of who this person is?
Yeah.
So that was on one side. On the other, there was a comedy podcast called I Love Movies with Doug Benson. He still does it. It's a live show with other comedians, many of whom I actually now know, which is great. But that one was tremendous fun to listen to, but I also got a sense from listening. I'm like, these guys know so much more about movies than they are letting on. Because for them, it's so much about the showmanship, understandably so, because they're in front of an audience. They want to entertain that audience, but it's so much about that I'm not getting the depth that I want. And so I thought, like, I can do this. I can be somewhere in between. But I would have to do it with the right person. And at the time I lived in Chicago, my wife and I were going to be moving out to Los Angeles and my old friend and roommate lived out here. And I said, and I pitched the idea to him that maybe we do a podcast where we have the types of conversations we had in college. But because it's two friends who have a certain degree of chemistry, hopefully that will come through. And not to toot my own horn, but I think it does. There are a lot of people that have said this feels like having a really good in-depth but fun conversation with my friends. And so I was like, all right, the in-depth and fun. I can live with both of those.
That's when podcasts are doing what they do best, because it is intimate. I mean, you're in somebody's ears while they're going about their life. You know, they're at work, they're on the treadmill. They're taking a hike.
that has helped me get through some hikes, yes.
But it is incredibly
distracted
intimate.
From this hell. But anyway, sorry.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, I used to when I moved out to Denver, I was taking public transportation everywhere, and it was taking me. I was living right in the city, and the tech center is way far out.
Oh sure.
And so, you know, when I was going to work, it was a 2-hour commute. One way, every day, 4 hours of my day was spent on buses and trains. And I learned how to reclaim that time and make it my own. But again, that comes down to facing the reality of the situation and recognizing what is my part in the creation of this reality. Because at first I just fucking hated it. I hated everything about it. I hated commuting. I hated being on a train. I thought in my head I was adding 4 hours of my personal precious time to my employer, and I wasn't getting paid for it. And I had this really negative attitude about it until I decided, you know, I don't have to drive. I'm not stuck in traffic. I can write.
Yeah, it can be productive. It can be relaxing if you let it be.
I can listen to podcasts. I can I can do all kinds of things. I can draw. I can, you know, this time is actually mine. I'm not stuck in traffic like everybody else down there. And once I did start driving, man, did I miss being on the train.
I when I was in school, both in Chicago and then here when I went back to school, I would take buses and trains. And it was quite nice because, like, all right, this is the rest of my day, whether it be in class or just, you know, at work or whatever, the rest of my day, I have to do something. I don't actually have to do anything right now, including navigate traffic. Someone else is doing that.
Yeah.
So I can decide. It goes back to what you're talking about as far as sort of trying to change your attitude or look at it from another perspective. Like you can either say, hey, this is a cumulative 4 hours that I could be doing something else, or it's, yeah, but the 4 hours are here either way.
Yes.
So can I utilize those 4 hours or just resent them?
Yeah.
And I think the number of people, I'm sure you've experienced as well, the number of podcast listeners that have said, I started listening while I was doing other things. Like I've talked to a shocking number of people that have worked at warehouses that while they're sweeping up the floors, they start listening to our show.
Oh yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, that's perfect.
I love warehouse people. I mean, that's bread and butter right there.
It's like 65% of the audience.
Yeah, absolutely it is. Stocking shelves. I mean, it's forklift drivers. Maybe, you know, take one earbud out, but it is pretty fascinating. But as far as changing perspectives on things, when did you start reshaping your own perspectives on things?
Well, that's the thing. When you initially asked the question, I started laughing because it feels so contradictory. That how is it that somebody who has such a historically low opinion of himself as I do, how is it that he somehow thought that he knew enough about movies and could talk about them in an entertaining enough way to start a podcast, much less start two and then eventually a third podcast, which is falling off. So the first one is called Battleship Pretension. That's about movies. Mm-hmm. The second one is called More Than One Lesson. That's also about movies, but it was about movies from a Christian perspective. That one's on hiatus. And then the third one I started with my wife, in which we just talk about the show Survivor because we love it so much. And that was just meant to be a bonding thing between the two of us, but that fell off because we were both very busy. There's definitely the darker voice in my head is like, where do you get off thinking that you have such a right opinion about movies, and that you think you can express it so uniquely that people should hear it? And to be honest, I don't really know. I guess it did come from this feeling of there is a gap and I feel like I can fill it. It came from that, but I don't know where I got that initial burst of confidence, to be honest with you. And I don't know why I have it week to week. I definitely have, going back to school and now being a teacher and all that, that has helped a little bit with my fraud complex. What do you call it?
You're absolutely right. Imposter syndrome.
Imposter syndrome. Thank you. That has helped a little bit, not nearly as much as one would assume. Like getting a master's degree in cinema media studies and then standing up in front of students who you clearly do know more than. It still doesn't help that much because now it feels like you're just a big fish in a small pond.
Right.
But there are – I do still have little crises, usually this time of year, to be honest with you. Because this is the time of year that other critics and other podcasters we're now zeroing in on like the end of year stuff, which is to say now we're talking about the best movies of the year and the Oscar bait movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Usually I have not spent enough time watching movies, and then we get to September, October, and I realize like, oh shit, I only have a couple of months to catch up and everybody else is ahead of me. Maybe if I prioritized movies and I wasn't such a fraud, maybe I would have done it by now. And it's just like my mind goes to that so fast. And I've been able, thankfully, to fight that a little bit more and be like, hey, you've got your own thing going. Other people do too. That's the way it goes. So what are you going to do now? And that's not a way of saying like, stop pitying yourself. It's more just like, you can take that energy spent hating yourself and actually turn it towards something not positive, but at the very least productive.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like today I saw a movie that people have been talking about for a while, and it's like, all right, I know that if nothing else today, I saw that one movie and now I can talk about it with other people. And that's something I didn't have yesterday. So, good for me.
But looking for those small victories really matters.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because they stack up.
Yeah.
You start to learn some things about yourself in the process as well. You know, you had mentioned even just a moment ago about this idea that you can have a master's degree in film and stand in front of people and talk about it and still feel unworthy in some arenas.
Oh, yeah.
But it's the thing about that is it's a constant process. And you really nailed it when you said, all right, well, I can look at this another way. And and taking those negative feelings and those negative thoughts that you have about yourself and directing that energy elsewhere – you're absolutely right. It doesn't mean that you have to make something good, but the very idea that you're doing something with that energy and you're acknowledging the fact that you don't like yourself right now, you don't feel good about things right now, you don't know what you're doing right now.
Yeah.
You know, you can have all of these things and still say, all right, but I'm going to move forward anyway.
And I think for me, I think I've gotten better at that over the years. The next step, which is a huge, it's more than a hurdle. It's a wall to get over, and I might spend the rest of my life getting over it. It's one thing to take that energy and move it towards something pragmatic, something practical, something helpful. Mm-hmm. But it's another, like, you know, what do I do in those moments where I have that feeling and there's literally nothing I can do right now or even today to start to alleviate that? It's literally like the way I describe it is if I have let my wife down, like if there's something that she needed me to do that day and I either forgot or I screwed it up, I feel really bad. She's upset, whatever it is. And there's this aspect, this almost compulsive aspect of me that's just like, well, you can either hate yourself or you can go and do something to like make it better. Well, there is a third option, which is acknowledge, just be like, yeah, I messed up. That doesn't mean I'm an unacceptable person. You know, like, why is it like hate yourself or get moving? Well, is there really nothing
both
in between? You can do both. Absolutely. Oh boy, that's true.
Yeah.
But it's the way I've described it in the past is being in a state of failure.
Yes.
And I have a tendency that until I go and do a good thing or I start to make things right, whatever that might mean, I am in a state of failure until that moment. And that is an unacceptable state for me to be in. And I need what my wife and I are working on and what I'm working on is what do I do until I'm able to make it better? Or what if I'm literally not able to make it better? Do I still have to live in that state of failure, or do I find a place where I'm at least where I can still be okay? That like, yeah, you made a mistake. You hurt someone you love. It happens. You feel bad about it. That's fine. You'll do better tomorrow, hopefully. But as for right now, you're still okay. You're still, to put it in Christian terms, you're still loved.
Yeah.
You haven't lost that love as a result. That's the really hard thing for me to accept. That's the really hard thing for me to get over, if I ever will, which is seems very unlikely to me, but it's, I at least realize that that's kind of my goal right now.
Well, it's a growing process. Yeah. You're never really done. You're always kind of tinkering. I mean, if you look at yourself as a house, you can definitely start saying, you know what? I never noticed these floors before. You know, I didn't pay attention to them. So I think I'll work on that now. And then you work on that, and then you go, oh, that's all right. Well, I mean, that's there, but now the walls look like this. And it's just a constant process of finding little things and going, you know what? Not a fan of those baseboards, but I mean, I can live with them. I can live with that. Let's move on to something else.
Yeah, it really is that feeling of I can live with that.
Yes.
And changing, and maybe changing your definition of what you can live with. Yeah. You know, being a homeowner myself and owning a home that is old now, I would say. Sorry, it's California old. Which
so
is
so it's 20?
It was built in the 50s.
Okay.
And the
previous that is California old.
Yeah. But it's, you know, it's got some character to it, we like to say. And so there were changes that we needed to make immediately because my wife works out of the house and has employees and that sort of thing. And then there are the changes you make gradually. And it's about sort of prioritizing. And what it ultimately is, like what you're talking about, to keep the metaphor going, it is realizing like, okay, what needs to be done now? You know, oh, our refrigerator is not working. Okay, that needs to be done now. Because we are spoiling food and that kind of thing. So that needs to be done now, as opposed to, you mentioned like the floors.
Yeah.
Okay. The floors probably need to be refinished. That is not urgent. It's important.
Yeah.
It's not urgent. So like recognizing what's urgent, what's important, and then what in the end is like, why am I so upset about this thing or that thing? And so, so figuring out, myself figuring out oneself and what is, as far as the changes and the flaws, what's urgent, what's important, and then what is in the end acceptable. I feel like that's, as you said, that's a lifelong process, and I'm 37. So I feel old, especially when I'm, now that I'm teaching people that are half my age.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still feel pretty young.
Do you think that, learning to start to make some changes within yourself and the way that you treat yourself and the language that you use when you talk about yourself has had an impact on your relationship with your wife?
Oh my, yes, absolutely. Because if I hate myself, then the only, you know, this is such a cliche thing, but I'm a big fan of the movie Citizen Kane.
Yeah.
And the whole aspect, and I watch it in my film classes, and I watched it last week. It was probably my 20th time watching it. I've seen it a million times, but for some reason, watching it that time hit me a very specific way from a relational standpoint. And the idea of Citizen Kane is that he is constantly trying to get love from other people while giving very little, because he doesn't really know how.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is, that's important to him because he's sort of not necessarily defining himself by other people, but he's deriving his worth from other people and their view of him. And so if I have a very low sense of self-worth, then I'm going to put a lot of pressure on my wife to give me that worth. You know, it's like, hey, I may be a complete fraud as a film critic, and I may be intellectually and emotionally lazy, and I may be fat and worthless. Like, just to give you an idea of the words that pop up in my head.
Yeah.
I may be all of that, but, well, at least my wife loves me. It's like, that's a lot of pressure to put on your wife. Like when your sense of self is hanging by a string and that string is held by one other person, then it doesn't give them the freedom to make mistakes. So yeah, the more, I think it's helpful, not just for me, but for her and my friends, to have a better view of myself, or at least a more well-rounded view of myself.
It is also a lot easier on you once you're able to let go of a lot of things and just be open.
Yeah.
There's a freedom in it. And I mean, freedom can sometimes really suck, but,
yes.
But ultimately it's usually worth it. It's worth flipping that coin, you know?
Yeah, and it's odd that you say coin, because the thing that my wife and I talk about regularly is the idea of there are two sides to the coin, and there's a tendency certainly on her side and on my side, she tends to think of herself as pretty great. By her own admission, she has a hard time apologizing. She also has a hard time saying thank you, because she's just really good at a lot of things, and she doesn't actually make that many mistakes from a logistical side, logistical standpoint. So she sees a certain one side of the coin. I look at myself and see just a constant fuck up, and I look at that side. But of course, there are two sides to every coin. Like, what is the negative side of being right all the time? One is that you stop trusting other people.
Yeah.
And you don't think they're going to get it right ever. And as a result, you're going to be as harsh on them as you would be on yourself. And on my side, it's like, yeah, I'm not really great with logistical things. I'm maybe oversensitive, but what's the other side to that coin? The other side is that I am sensitive. I am someone that can speak really well and help other people with their emotions, and I can help them have breakthroughs as I have breakthroughs. And so both she and I have a tendency to look at only one side of our coin without recognizing that there is a whole other side. And again, it speaks to this idea of acknowledging the positive and the negative, that if you acknowledge both and recognizing that, yes, you do need – things need to be changed. But until you recognize both, like, how can you even hope to change if you don't have at least a slightly more complete view of oneself?
Yeah. You've really got to have an understanding of the way everything is now before mm-hmm. you can even start thinking about change.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is I don't think you're ever going to fully understand how things are now, but you have to have an eye towards it at least, you know? Trying to discover that while also cutting yourself and your friends and your loved ones, cutting them as much slack as possible, because the more you uncover, the more astonishing everything will seem. Meanwhile, it's totally old hat, and there's, you know, my issues. It's really fascinating. Whenever I hear people talk about depression or anxiety or any kind of mental issue, it's almost funny when they say the exact thing that I said years ago when I was first diagnosed. But it felt so unique to me. I felt so not special, but I felt so
isolated.
That's perfect. Yes. I felt so isolated in my illness, or whatever you want to say,
totally.
In my struggles.
Yeah.
And then you hear someone say the exact same thing, you know, I was reluctant to take antidepressants because I was worried that it would change my personality. Granted, I didn't much like my personality, but I did recognize that, yeah, but I have a pretty good sense of humor, and I have a very specific way of looking at the world that helps me as a film critic. And to quote a Tom Waits lyric, if I exercise my devils, my angels may leave too.
Yeah.
which is a very standard thought. And so I was just like really reluctant. I was like, I'm going to lose who I am. And then I literally just watched the comedian Gary Gulman. He has a special on HBO called The Great Depression.
Yes.
And as he's describing not taking pills, it's the exact same. Everybody says the same thing, which is, I don't want to take this because it might change who I am. And in actuality, what my wife said, which I am very thankful for, is that maybe the depression is keeping you from being who you are, and you are just blind to that. And yes. The medicine will actually remove that obstacle, and you can be more yourself instead of less. And sure enough, once I started taking them and we started to see a real change after about a month or two, she said, I feel like you're you again, or at least starting to be you. And so I definitely – it's the idea of you're not alone – is one that can be very comforting, but it also, for me, the reason that it worked so well as time has gone on is that, like, if other people have dealt with this and are still around, then that can be in itself a resource, either directly or indirectly, like as they talk about the stuff that worked for them. But if I do feel completely isolated and one could say less unique as a result, then I'm not, if I don't have an idea of how to treat this, then I'm out of ideas. But there is a community of ill people, I'm not going to say broken people, everybody's broken, but like there's a community of ill people who have been struggling with many of the same things. And, I don't know. And as time has gone on, I've found tremendous comfort in that. Like that special, it made me cry at times because of the recognizability of what he was talking about.
Yes, absolutely. And you really have to get comfortable with the concept of failure, yours and the failures of the people around you. You have to get really comfortable with the idea that other people that you love are going to let you down sometimes. It's just a fact. It's how it works. But that's okay. You've just got to get comfortable with that idea, letting yourself have the same amount of slack that you would give somebody else.
Yeah, I quoted Tom Waits earlier. I'm also a big fan of Pink Floyd's The Wall. I'm a fan of Pink Floyd in general, but The Wall is the one that really deals with a lot of the stuff we're talking about here.
Yeah.
And the very last track on the album is, let's see, I'm trying to think if I can remember it. All Alone or In Twos, the ones who really love you, walk up and down outside the wall. And when they've given you their all, some stagger and fall, after all, it's not easy, banging your heart against some mad body's wall. And that idea that like, yeah, good God, my wife has had to deal with a lot of shit on my part.
Yeah.
She's had to deal with, you know, when I'm reluctant to say this, but like, yeah, she's had to, we've had to remove sleeping pills from the house because of me, because of stuff that I've really wanted to do. She's had to drop what she's doing and talk to me. And that's not easy. Like she's trying to live her own life as well and run a business and deal with her own shit as well.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing is it's tough. I feel like the nature of depression, if not mental illness in general, but I'd say depression especially, it is just such an unforgiving illness, and not just of me, but of everybody else as well. Like it just doesn't – failure is just so unacceptable. And so my failure obviously is unacceptable, but when other people fail me, if I were to give depression a voice, it ultimately says, yeah, I told you. You cannot rely on anybody.
Yeah.
And that is that's very unforgiving of other people. And so like the idea of grace and forgiveness, and cutting people slack, whatever you want to say, including yourself, I think it's incredibly hard to do, but I feel like that's a huge first step in starting to fight depression to the degree that you can.
Yeah. And there's a lot that can be done, in both learning when to let go of other people and the expectations that you have, and when to pull people close.
Mm-hmm.
But that's life in general. That's a process. And sometimes, if you're a person with depression, the thing that I'm a big fan of is trying to educate people in the language.
Yeah.
Because the fact of the matter is, there's a lot of fear from people without depression of talking to people with depression. And so they tend to say things like, you know what, you're not a burden, you're not a problem.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is sometimes you are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a fact. And but the other side of that is that the piece that's so important to hear is not that I'm not a burden or that my depression isn't a sinkhole in my marriage sometimes.
Right.
The part that I need to hear and that other people need to hear when they're feeling that way is, yeah, this is hard right now, but that's okay.
Yeah. And it's that, and it goes to what I was talking about earlier about honesty, is that we tend to feel like, okay, well, in order to make this person feel better, I will be artificially nice and say, no, you're not a burden. And the person is lying. Of course, yeah. Of course they're a burden.
Yeah.
And here's a little tip. If anybody's listening that doesn't have depression, but they know someone that does, that person has a, they assume that every nice thing you say is bullshit anyway. So
yes.
If you say like, yeah, this is hard. Of course it's hard. And it breaks my heart to see you like this. And it puts a lot of pressure on me, but I'm willing to stick it out. I'm willing to deal with that because I love you. I'm not going to say it's not hard, but it's worth it. And by the way, sometimes it doesn't feel worth it. And I have to remind myself that it's worth it. Like that to me, like that is some, that's some very real, very honest, talk. And I feel like I would appreciate that. I have appreciated that when my wife has said it. But if you simply say, no, it's fine. We know you're lying.
Yeah.
We know you're lying.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah. So, go ahead and be honest with me and just let me know that there is an end to this in sight. You know, where it's, you know, this sucks right now. This is bad right now. This is hard right now. But we're going to be okay. We're going to survive this and, you know, move on to the next thing. Sometimes that's really all you need.
And there will be a next thing. That's the other thing. Is
there will be a next thing.
Once we get past this, everything is smooth sailing. We know that's not true, and so do you. But it's the idea that because we get over this, maybe the next thing won't be quite as difficult. You know? Oh, boy. I feel like this has become kind of a downer episode. But I guess that's the nature of what we're talking about.
It can be. But honestly, at the same time, I find it really exciting because it's digging in the mud, panning for gold, you know?
Yeah.
And getting these shared ideas and, you know, banging them into each other, you know, it's like we're trading baseball cards here, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't know. I don't have any ideas. What do you got? Oh, you got some. Oh, that's cool. I like that. I'm going to put this in the toolbox and, you know, we'll see how that works. So we can end on a more upbeat note. I wanted to ask you a question. What is your favorite movie about depression?
All right. I was anticipating this question because it is something that I think about a lot. Because I think there are a lot of movies that get mental illness wrong.
Yes.
And they get depression wrong. Like there's a movie directed by Jodie Foster starring Mel Gibson called The Beaver.
Yes.
And there are aspects to that movie that I really like.
Yep.
But depression doesn't mean mopey.
Yes.
You know what I mean? It can, absolutely, of course. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. And that's the thing is depression is also a really, really hard thing to show on film.
Yes.
Because it's like, it's
so internal.
Yeah. Thrill as Bill Murray can't get out of bed. You know, it's not that. Like it's not the most cinematic of mental illnesses. Oh, multiple personalities though. Get ready with an Oscar because that person is going to do great. So it's hard for me to say about depression specifically, especially if a character is not actually diagnosed as depressed. But I would say I mentioned Bill Murray earlier. I would say in Lost in Translation and then Broken Flowers a couple years later, there's a real isolated sadness to him. And you can just see in it, like his energy level is just so low. But then when the whole idea is that he then feels a chance at connection with another person, not necessarily romantic connection. In fact, not that, but just a real kinship with another person. And so he really, runs towards that. But I will say that my favorite movie about mental illness, although the film actually does keep it kind of ambiguous, whether it's mental illness or actual like something supernatural, the movie Take Shelter. Have you ever seen Take Shelter?
No.
It's a 2011 movie. It's got Michael Shannon. It has Michael Shannon and Jessica Chastain. And Michael Shannon plays a guy who I'm going to have a hard time talking about this without welling up because he's a guy who starts having like visions of like a horrible future. And so he starts making a storm shelter for his family. And it's in many ways, it almost feels like a Noah story where it's like this guy thinks something's going to happen. And so he prepares and everybody thinks he's crazy,
yeah,
including his own wife. And the film does suggest that maybe there is more going on than just this, but everybody understandably thinks that he is losing his mind and there's mental illness in his family. And we see things from his perspective, but we also see things from his wife's perspective as she wants to love this man, is trying to love this man, and it's becoming, but the man that he is becoming is less and less the man that she fell in love with. And so there is a great performances on everybody's side.
Yeah.
And I will say that there is a scene where he makes a public spectacle of himself, and her reaction in that scene is one of the most uplifting but truthful responses to anything like this in a movie. And I see that and it brings me to tears, and it reminds me of how my wife has dealt with me on some of my particularly bad days. And it's just a beautiful movie. It's very uncomfortable in many ways, as one might expect.
Yeah.
But it is just a beautiful movie. It's called Take Shelter once again.
Take Shelter. Well, I can't wait to watch it, and I can't thank you enough for coming on here to have this conversation with me.
Only somebody who deals with this kind of thing would hear the story of Take Shelter and be like, I can't wait.
Yeah.
What a romp.
That's me.
you know what? I'm the same way, though. I feel like other things, you know, like Manchester by the Sea deals with, I wouldn't necessarily say depression, but certainly the grief and guilt and the way it just stunts somebody to the point where they just feel as though they don't deserve anything good in their lives and that kind of thing. But
yeah.
And there are other examples I can think of, I'm sure. But off the top of my head, Take Shelter is the one that that's usually my go-to.
Well, I think we're all going to have reviews for you on that.
That's all
right. That's the homework for this episode.
Sure. That's why people listen to podcasts.
Yeah. Homework.
To get an assignment. Yeah.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun. Well, yeah, no, it was fun.
And there you have it. Wasn't that a great conversation? I hope that Tyler and I are still friends. After I unintentionally delayed the release of this podcast episode by, you know, easily a couple of months. But if you want to find more Tyler in your life and tell him to reach out to me, you can reach him at battleshippretension.com. He's got podcasts and videos and way more prolific than I am. But that's all I got for this week, everybody. And I will be back next week. And the week after that. And the week after that. You can go to the brand new coffeeoversuicide.com and tell me what's wrong with the website design, because I did it myself. But until next week, don't kill yourselves out there. And wash your hands. And don't touch your face.